and mortgage foreclosures. He wrote in a clear, straightforward style, emphasizing the facts of the cases without embellishment. Usually, he managed to complete these accounts before dinner, allowing him time to relax in the evenings. In his early 20s, Will found himself the center of a lively set of young friends, enjoying to the fullest the wealth of social activities Cincinnati provided. With a population of 250,000, the Queen City had come of age in the 1870s, boasting an array of cultural events that included classical music, opera festivals, theatrical performances, literary societies, and art exhibits. Washington will remain our political, and New York our commercial capital, Murat Halstead predicted in 1878, but cosmopolitan Cincinnati would become the social center and musical metropolis of America. Will Taft cut quite a figure in this bustling society. Large, handsome, and fair, with the build of a Hercules and the sunny disposition of an innocent child, one local newspaper described him. Women were drawn by his open, engaging manner, and he, in turn, was completely at ease conversing with them. He listened sympathetically to their concerns, valued their intelligence, and displayed an unselfconscious candor. At dancing parties, he sparkled, surprisingly light on his feet. He and his compatriots enjoyed picnics on the Ohio River, sledding parties, debutante balls, nights at the theater, whist parties, tennis matches, baseball games, and song fests at the beer gardens in Over the Rhine, the German section. With growing apprehension, Alfonso observed his son's diversions, convinced that without the structured environment that had compelled diligence at Yale, Will was simply marking time. Tensions between father and son only grew when Will went to work in his father's office in the summer of 1879, between his first 2 years in law school. In late June, Will departed for several days to visit one of his college friends in Cleveland. In his absence, a woman sought legal help in a small case involving the destruction of $300 worth of property. Seeing this as a capital opportunity for Will to handle a jury trial with several witnesses to be sworn, Alfonso sent him a letter requesting his immediate return. "I had the case laid over to next Saturday so that you might prepare and try it," he told his son. "I shall be sorry to have you lose it." The next day, Alfonso wrote again, venting his irritation. Will should disregard the previous letter, for he had agreed on a settlement of the case, a thing which you could have done if you had been here and carried a nice little fee for yourself. Alfonso's exasperation and disappointment were clear. "This gratifying your fondness for society is fruitless," he admonished. "I like to have you enjoy yourself, so far as it can be consistent with your success in life. But you will have to be on alert for business and for influence among men, if you would hope to accomplish success." Alfonso had not exhausted his censure, however, for yet a third letter followed the next day. "I do not think you should make arrangements for a second visit at Cleveland or for anything but close application to study and business. There is no day in week you will not have as much as you are able to do. You must acquire a mastery of the German language as well as of the law, and you should be forming valuable business acquaintance, if not political. I do not think that you have accomplished as much this past year as you ought with your opportunities. You must not feel that you have time enough to while away with every friend who comes." Alfonso worried too much. Will finished law school in good standing. Then, heeding his father's advice, he shuttered himself in the law office for the month leading up to the bar examination, combing the shelves of standard legal tomes. Will informed his friends that he would not be seen in public again until after the tests. He easily passed and was admitted to the bar. His solid work as a court reporter for the Cincinnati Commercial had, meanwhile, earned Halstead's esteem and a full-time job offer at a salary of $1,500 a year. Although his calling was to the law rather than journalism, he remained on the newspaper staff through the summer and fall. There, his coverage of a dramatic embezzlement trial against Cy Hoffman, a Democratic auditor for the city, led to an unexpected opportunity. Counsel for the defendant in the Hoffman case was the criminal attorney Tom Campbell, head of a political ring said to have dug its talons deep in the judiciary. Campbell reputedly owned court officers, regularly bribed witnesses and juries, and was able to secure any verdict he desired. The Hoffman case took a sensational turn when Miller Outcault, the assistant prosecuting attorney, charged that his chief, Prosecutor Samuel Drew, had conspired with the unscrupulous Campbell to fix the jury and assure Hoffman's acquittal. For the idealistic young Taft, the picture of judicial corruption was deeply disturbing. He later acknowledged that he fell in with Miller Outcault, providing reports that aided his efforts to expose both the chief prosecutor and the disreputable attorney. The Cincinnati Commercial stories about the dramatic proceedings created widespread interest in the case. Large crowds packed the courthouse, spectators standing upon the railing, desks, and chairs as day after day, Outcault leveled a nasty torrent of abuse against both Campbell and his boss. After 2 weeks of the bitterest invective from all parties in this singular three-cornered fight, the judge was compelled to dismiss Prosecutor Drew from the case. Proceedings were suspended until the district court sustained the judge's action. The jury finally received the case, but could not reach an agreement. A mistrial was declared. When Outcault replaced Drew as prosecuting attorney, he offered the post of assistant prosecuting attorney to Will Taft, who had just passed his 23rd birthday. Nellie Taft later declared that the experience he had in the rough-and-ready practice in criminal trials, in preparing cases for trial, in examining witnesses, in making arguments to the court, and in summing up to the jury, was the most valuable experience he could possibly have in fitting him for trial work at the bar. He prepared indictments for grand juries, took depositions, interviewed witnesses, and independently conducted a number of criminal trials, including a dramatic murder case. Only after 4 months on the job, he opened the prosecution's case in the state's second attempt to put City Auditor Hoffman behind bars. Once again, celebrated criminal defense lawyer Tom Campbell defended Hoffman. Once again, Campbell secured a hung jury, and suspicions of jury tampering abounded. Considering the marked contrast of disposition between Taft and Roosevelt, biographer Henry Pringle speculates that a Theodore Roosevelt might have won renown, glory, and headlines in this post of assistant district attorney. He might have publicly pledged to root out the corrupt dealings between officers of the court and the city's political machine. But Will Taft was no showman, nor was he, to the same extent, personally or politically ambitious. He valued the post solely as a vital contribution to his legal education. He was on his legs day after day before judge and jury, Horace recalled, and consequently became so expert in regard to the laws of evidence as to surprise the older lawyers when he mounted the bench. Although he harbored no political ambitions for himself, Taft took an active role in local Republican politics. During his father's race for governor, he canvassed the city in search of delegates to the state convention, remaining involved from that point forward. "I attended all the primaries and all the conventions," he later recalled, "and attempted to do what I could to secure respectable nominees for the party, especially for judicial places." He worked in his ward to defeat disreputable machine candidates by hustling around among good people to get them out. He never hesitated to attack the gang methods whenever he witnessed corruption at the polls. But while attacking their methods, he always stayed on good terms with all the various factions. His amiability and reluctance to hold a grudge made him, in the estimation of Republican Congressman Benjamin Butterworth, the most popular young man in Hamilton County. Beneath Will's benign nature, however, lay a sharp temper, especially when his family's honor was concerned. A weekly tabloid published an anonymous letter ridiculing Alfonso, along with the insidious suggestion that Louise Taft herself had authored the attack. Determined to seek revenge for this slander against both his parents, Will sought out the tabloid editor, Lester A. Rose. Charlie cautioned restraint since Rose was known to be a bruiser of considerable physical courage and great endurance. Undaunted, Will confronted Rose on a street corner and administered what the newspapers termed a terrible beating. He reportedly lifted him up and dashed him to the pavement, executing continuous blows and hammering his head against the ground until Rose promised to leave town that very night. The story of the thrashing made news across the country. "The feeling among all classes of citizens," observed the Bismarck Tribune, "is that Mr. Taft did a public service and ought to have a medal." At his father's urging, Will began stumping for Republican candidates in his county. "I want him to accustom himself to speaking from the beginning," Alfonso told Delia Torrey, explaining that as a lawyer, he is to make speaking a business, and he should do it well. Will was sick with anxiety before his maiden political speech, aghast to see his name, the Honorable William H. Taft, plastered on posters throughout the city. "Don't allow yourself to be discouraged," his father urged him. "It is a great undertaking, but it is the best thing that can happen to you. It will be worth a fortune to you if you can conquer the difficulties and speak well in public. I know it is hard work to get adequate preparation. You will find it difficult to commit literally a long speech. I do not attempt it. You will have your memory helped by notes of the points." Will followed his father's advice, and the speech, which he delivered 3 times in 3 different venues, went well. "He finds the farmers make attentive listeners, and he is not embarrassed," Louise noted. "There is every prospect that he will be a first-class speaker," Alfonso wishfully predicted, "and a first-class lawyer, too." In January of 1882, Taft's popularity with the discordant factions of the Republican Party led Congressman Benjamin Butterworth to recommend him to President Chester Arthur as collector of internal revenue for the Cincinnati district. The sitting collector, affiliated with a coalition considered unfriendly to the president, had been dismissed. His removal threatened to escalate political strife unless a replacement was found who could mollify all sides. "If you will appoint Will Taft to this important position, everybody will be satisfied," Butterworth told Arthur. Taft's mother opposed the idea. "I did not wish Will to go into politics," she said. "I wished him to engage in nothing not in the line of his profession." His father, too, questioned the appointment, fearing that Taft was too young to lead a staff of more than 100 employees in the task of collecting over $10 million from the sales of whiskey and tobacco. Taft later acknowledged that he was offered the post, making him the youngest collector in the country, predominantly because he had no political enemies. It is likely that this decision to interrupt his emerging legal career was less a function of ambition than of desire to satisfy Congressman Butterworth and President Arthur. Indeed, this unwillingness to disappoint others would continue to shape the course of his professional life. While Taft possessed a highly developed social intelligence, he was less discerning of his own strengths and weaknesses. Still, it did not take him long to realize that the work was decidedly ill-suited to his temperament. He detested the prominence of the position and could not bear the criticism that inevitably came with the job, acknowledging years later that he was too thin-skinned for public life. Moreover, his moderate reformist tendencies were at odds with the prevailing customs of the day. At a time when civil service reform was still in its infancy, when political patronage, rather than merit, filled the majority of positions, government employees were expected to contribute part of their salaries to the party in power. Horace recalled that when the local Republican Party circulated a subscription list demanding money from each of the department employees, Taft made a contribution in his own name, but announced that he would not look at the subscriptions made by any of his employees. Ruffled party members charged that he was wrecking the party by the course he followed. Taft's troubles multiplied during a bitter contest for the congressional nomination in the 2nd District between Governor Tom Young and Amor Smith. Young sent a letter to Taft demanding the removal of a number of men in the Revenue Department who he claimed were allied with his opponent. Taft refused, resenting the bulldozer tone of the letter. "The half-dozen men whose removal the governor demanded," he countered, "are among the best men in this district in the energy, skill, and faithfulness with which they discharge their duties. If removed, they must be simply and solely removed because they would prefer Amor Smith's nomination to yours." Regarding Young's implied threat to involve President Arthur in the situation, Taft argued that the popularity of the present administration in this country has been strengthened by the fidelity with which we have tried to follow the president's moderate course in national affairs in regard to civil service. In a letter to his father, Taft defiantly declared, "I would much rather resign and let someone else do Tom Young's service and dirty work." In an effort to avoid public dissension, he decided to write to the president directly. "The men whose removal he seeks," Taft told the president, "are such men as practical and conscientious politicians delight to find, men of political power and of ability to discharge their official duties." He promised Arthur that these employees supported the administration. They simply preferred Smith to Young. Though Young eventually backed down, the disagreeable conflict intensified Taft's desire to resume the practice of law. "I long to get out of politics," he told his father in October, "and get down to business." A month later, after less than a year on the job, he journeyed to Washington and asked the president to accept his resignation. "I am mighty glad he is going to resign," Horace told his mother. With clear admiration for his older brother, he added, "I'll bet one thing, and that is they won't get a man in that place very soon who knows more about the law and business of the office than he does, or who abstains more carefully from the dirty parts of politics. Will makes fun of me for being so radical, theoretical, and impractical in my opinions, but when it comes to the point, I think he is a thorough civil service reformer in practice." Palpably relieved to be free of political discord, Taft penned a long letter to his father, then enjoying a pleasant stint in Vienna as the American foreign minister to Austria-Hungary at the behest of President Arthur. Will happily reported his intent to go into partnership with his father's former law partner, Major Lloyd, a widely respected figure in Cincinnati. "It is the opening of what I hope will be my life's work," he said. "Of course I shall have to work hard, but that will agree with me, and I shall have that sweetest of all pleasures, the feeling of something accomplished, something done in the life that I have marked out for myself." It was a rare moment of insight into his own feelings and desires. Alfonso was gratified to hear that his son was leaving politics, to work at the law with all his might, he told Charlie. That is his destiny. By early 1883, Taft was settled in his new job. Charlie's wife, Annie, believed that since departing the politically embroiled revenue department, Will looked younger by several years. In January, Taft wrote his sister, Fanny, with evident satisfaction. "I wish you could look in on me now, seated in my cozy library with a cheerful soft coal fire and lots of easy chairs, with the familiar old pictures looking down on me from every wall." That summer, he planned to take his first trip abroad to visit his parents. "I hope you will make yourselves comfortable and elegant, even if it is a little expensive," he teased them. "You're off on a lark, and we are willing to extend your allowance a little to ensure you're having a good time." After 3 months in Europe, however, he was glad to get home and resume his law practice. "Will is working well and seems very happy," Major Lloyd reported to Alfonso. Will and Horace roomed together on the west side of Broadway when Horace, after graduating from Yale, also returned to Cincinnati to study law. Tall, spare, with a refreshing sense of humor, Horace relished politics more than his brother, and would become a fervent advocate for reform. "Horace makes friends wherever he goes," Will reported to his sister, "because his honest good nature and straightforward character shines out of him." Will also confided in Fanny his hope that his own law practice would grow large enough in some years to warrant my making an ass of myself in regard to some girl. By his 25th birthday, however, he confessed that he was "no nearer matrimony than I was when I first went into society. In the loneliness that I sometimes feel stealing over me, the temptation in that direction is strong. But with no object to satisfy the feeling, the thought passes like many other castles in the air." If Will felt he lacked the proper foundation to marry, he was certainly entertaining eligible candidates. When the opera festival came to Cincinnati during the first week in February, Taft reported to his mother and sister that he was planning to take a different girl each evening. Nellie Herron on Monday night, Edith Harrison on Tuesday, Miss Lawson on Wednesday, Miss Tomlin on Thursday, Alice Keys on Saturday afternoon, and Agnes Davis on Saturday night. Considering this parade of young women, he could not escape the fancied sound of Alfonso's admonitions. "I see Father shake his head when he reads this list, and hear him say that a thorough knowledge of the law is not obtained in that way." The revival of Taft's legal career reignited a clash with his old nemesis, Tom Campbell. A wave of ghastly murders in 1883, including a husband and wife killed for the $30 their bodies would be worth to a dissection class at the medical school, had created panic throughout Cincinnati. And amidst this widespread anxiety, a particularly vicious killing of a liveryman on Christmas Eve of 1883 set in motion a series of events that shook the foundation of Cincinnati. The prosecution charged that 17-year-old William Burner and an accomplice had robbed and killed their employer, William Kirk, by beating him savagely on the head with a blacksmith's hammer and club. They hid the body in a covered wagon, fled with $345, and enjoyed a night of revelry in numerous saloons. When the victim's body was discovered, the pockets of his jacket were filled with Christmas presents he was taking home to his family. Evidence implicated Burner, who confessed 6 times to 6 different people, detailing the planning and execution of the cold-blooded butchery. Before the trial commenced, Burner, in order to avoid hanging, agreed to plead guilty to murder in the second degree. The prosecution refused, certain that the evidence for first-degree murder was absolute and unquestioned, and that the heinous nature of the crimes deserved punishment by death. Tom Campbell was enticed to defend Burner with the hefty fee of $5,000 offered by the father of the accused young man. It proved a sage investment. With the powerfully connected Campbell leading the defense, the jury delivered a shocking verdict. After deliberating but 24 hours, they rejected both first and second degree murder charges, finding Burner guilty only of murder in the third degree. Cincinnati residents were stunned and outraged, convinced that the father of the murderer had purchased the verdict through a cunning lawyer who had corrupted the jury. While not the first miscarriage of justice that Cincinnati had witnessed, it was certainly the most infamous. The people of Cincinnati are abundantly warned that the law furnishes no protection to life, declared the Cincinnati Commercial Gazette. Justice, the New York Times reported, was poisoned at its source. The peace and safety of society were betrayed by the agency chosen to defend them. It is a terrible fact that money outweighs human life, and that the land of the law is palsied by bribes. A number of papers grimly noted that the lower courts in too many cities across the country had become the mere agents of unscrupulous attorneys who dictate acquittals or convictions at will. So scandalous and notorious has it become that lawyers now openly boast that they own this or that court. A mass meeting was held at the Music Hall on March 29, 1884, to protest both the verdict and the corrupting influence of the Campbell Organization. Speakers addressed the crowd, and a committee was formed to revise the rules governing the selection of juries. The proceedings were repeatedly interrupted by outbursts of "Hang the jury! Hang Tom Campbell! Hang Burner!" and a large, boisterous element remained after the meeting adjourned. After some excited deliberation, they thronged to the jail, determined to find Burner and deliver by lynching the justice denied by the court. Gathering strength on every corner, the crowd grew to nearly 1,000 by the time it reached the jail. There, the mob divided into 3 groups. The first division stormed the courthouse, ran through the tunnel leading to the jail, and managed to break through the heavy iron doors at the end of the tunnel. The second group shattered the south windows and demolished the chapel on the way to the rotunda. With a heavy ram, the third group battered down the iron entrance to the jail and raced up a winding stairway to reach the cells. Burner, however, was nowhere to be found. For his safety, he had already been transferred to another jail. In their fury, the mob set the courthouse ablaze. Order was finally restored with the arrival of the police and the state militia, but in the course of the struggle, 45 men were killed and more than 100 injured. Many thousands of dollars of property was lost. The New York Times declared it the bloodiest affair that ever occurred in Cincinnati. A few weeks later, a grand jury brought an indictment against Campbell for bribing several of the jurors. Taft rightly surmised that it would be impossible to obtain testimony because the only witnesses of Campbell's rascalities are men who were as deeply implicated in them as he was. Campbell chose for his counsel Joseph Foraker, a rising political ally, and was acquitted by a jury unable to reach a verdict. Taft complained to his father that Foraker had conducted the defense in a most shystering and ungentlemanly way. In the future, he pledged, "I shall do everything I can against Foraker in every political fight." The Cincinnati Bar Association, meanwhile, decided to create a committee to prepare sufficient evidence for a disbarment suit against Campbell in the district court. Taft was chosen by the senior members of the bar to serve as junior counsel for the 9-person committee. This appointment, Horace noted years later, was an extraordinary honor, considering his youth, and was not to be accounted for by smiling good nature. Alfonso worried about the consequences of a direct collision with Campbell and the insidious forces behind him, fearing even for his son's physical safety. Will, however, relished the chance to confront the man who had thrown the bar of Hamilton County into disrepute. He stridently announced to his father that it was time for men to have backbone and drive away the scourge that has been such an infliction on this community for so many years. Those who tamely cower in the face of attack I have no use for. I have gone into this thing fully realizing the dangerous enemy we have to encounter. The committee presented its findings before the district court in July of 1884, and a trial date was set for November. Horace proudly recalled that his brother was instrumental in building the case for senior members of the committee. Will had traveled throughout Ohio, compiling evidence and interviewing witnesses to document a pattern of disreputable behavior that had persisted for years. While his law practice suffered, and his father feared that Campbell's stranglehold on the judicial system would make a thankless task of all his endeavors, Taft found the work exhilarating. The intensity of his pursuit drained young Taft of any remnant zeal for political campaigning. "I find that the Campbell case has robbed politics of any interest for me," he told his father at the start of the 1884 presidential race between Republican James Blaine and Democrat Grover Cleveland. "If I can assist to get rid of Campbell, I think that I shall have accomplished a much greater good than by yelling myself hoarse for Blaine." As the election neared, however, he succumbed to pressure from Congressman Butterworth and agreed to serve as chief supervisor of elections in the city. He was charged with organizing forces to man the polling places, where intimidation and fraud were rampant. Repeat voters numbered in the thousands, and hundreds of men voted the cemetery. Taft had done his job well. Republicans carried the city and the state, though Cleveland won the presidential election. "Your son Will did splendid service in the campaign," Butterworth informed Alfonso. "He is a magnificent fellow. If he has a flaw in him, I don't know where it is. He is not only brainy, but brave, honorable, and honest." Despite such accolades, the political world held little appeal for Taft. "This is my last election experience, I hope, for some years to come," he told his mother. Campbell's disbarment trial opened before 3 district court judges on November 6, 1884, 2 days after the election. The investigation, Taft explained to his father, would undertake to prove acts at the different periods of Campbell's professional career to show a consistent course of unprofessional conduct down to the present time. Taft sat beside the senior attorneys who argued the case, providing documents, facts, and affidavits. The trial continued through December, with closing arguments slated for January 5th. On that crucial day, the senior attorney scheduled to present the prosecution's closing summary fell ill, and William Taft was selected to take his place. Suddenly emerging from obscurity, biographer Henry Pringle notes, to play the part of a leading actor. He took the floor for 4 hours and 10 minutes, revealing an absolute mastery of the complex case. Point by point, Taft enumerated the charges against Campbell, reviewing the evidence presented over the previous 20 days. Emphasizing that the members of the Cincinnati Bar Association were actuated by no other motive than a desire that the profession should be purged of a man whose success in this community threatens every institution of justice that is dear to us or necessary to good governance. Taft offered a powerful concluding summary. "We have presented the case which we think calls for the action of your honors in saying that the profession must be kept pure. We deny nothing to Mr. Campbell except integrity, and we say that that is the essential, the indispensable quality of a member of the bar." On the final day, Campbell took the stand, delivering an impassioned and eloquent plea on his own behalf. There was not a vindictive word uttered, and one looked in vain for any of the characteristics or manner of speech of the Thomas C. Campbell of 1 year ago, the Commercial Gazette reported. Tears were welling in his eyes, and there was a look of keen mental suffering upon his face as he described the pain and humiliation endured from the first filing of these charges to the present moment. He ascribed the smoke or suspicion that shadowed him largely to his active engagement in bitter political wranglings through the years, in which he had blindly made enemies who had multiplied. He acknowledged that the public had been worked up to the highest pitch of feeling during the Berner case, and that his decision to defend Berner had cost him greatly. He closed with a sentimental flourish, directly impugning Taft as the assassin of his character. "Mr. Taft has said that the relators deny me nothing save integrity. That is like saying, 'Let me wound you just once with a rapier, and I will be merciful and thrust you not through the arm or the leg, but through the heart.' Integrity is to a man what chastity is to a woman. When that is gone, all is gone." Taft anxiously waited week after week while the three judges deliberated. He believed both the reputation of the legal profession and the confidence of the public in the judicial system were at stake. Congressman Butterworth warned that Tom Campbell controls one of the judges absolutely, and one of the others partially. Nevertheless, few were prepared for the stunning verdict, delivered on February 3rd, that exonerated Campbell of all charges, save a minor one, which merited no suspension from the bar. "It was disastrous and disgraceful," Taft reported to his father. "I am glad to say that this is the universal opinion." Indeed, Butterworth observed that, whatever may be said of the full, clear, complete technical legal certainty, the moral proof is absolutely overwhelming that Campbell and his ring represent the social, moral, political, legal rot of Cincinnati. "I am very glad now that I spoke," Taft told his father. "The labor was very great, and it is discouraging to have such an ending," he avowed. "But the public generally and the bar are disposed to think that we tried the case as well as it could be tried." From his faraway perch in St. Petersburg, Russia, where he had been appointed a second ministerial job, Alfonso agreed. "I was very much pleased with your argument," he assured his son. "I think you must have a great majority of the community on your side, and you will find it will be remembered in your favor. You must not allow yourself to be discouraged by the folly and perverseness, if not wickedness, of men who have by some accident come into a little brief authority." As the weeks went by, Taft managed to recover a measure of optimism. "It is the beginning of an era of reform," he excitedly told his father. "The trial of his case has shorn Campbell of that veneer of respectability. Everybody knows he was guilty. He and the court have gone down together." He also reported a curious shift in his own perception of the matter and the man. "I can hardly explain to you the change in my feeling in regard to him. I have no personal animus toward him. He is no more to me than one of the thieves or bunksmen whom I know. He hates me with a perfect hatred, but I am indifferent to his feeling toward me." Taft's satisfaction with his own performance in the case was certainly justified. And, in an ironic turn of events, his involvement also aided his judicial ambitions. Will's unlikely benefactor would be Campbell's ally, Joseph Foraker, who, much to Will's disgust, became the Republican gubernatorial nominee several months after the trial. "I should not bow my head in tears," Taft confessed, "if the Democratic candidate defeated him." Despite Taft's grave reservations about the double-faced Campbell man, Foraker won the election and was returned to the governor's office 2 years later. In May of 1887, during Foraker's second term, a vacancy arose in the Ohio Superior Court when Judge Judson Harmon decided to retire with 14 months left on his elected term. To Taft's astonishment, Foraker offered to appoint him to fill the temporary vacancy until he could run for a full term. Considering Taft's manifest antipathy toward Foraker, Foraker's choice of Taft, not yet 30, remains an enigma. In a memoir written after Taft became president, Foraker's wife Julia claims an instant sympathy had developed between the two men when Taft, a cub reporter for the Cincinnati Commercial, covered cases over which her husband presided. "Foraker liked Taft's smile, liked his agreeable manner, liked his type of mind," she wrote. Foraker likewise recalled his own prescient respect for the young man after Taft had risen to eminence. Despite his youth, Foraker avowed, he knew him well enough to know that he had a strong intellectual endowment, a keen, logical, analytical, legal mind, and that all the essential foundations for a good judge had been well and securely laid. Taft would surely have denied this instant sympathy with a man he roundly disliked. It is more likely that in appointing a young lawyer with Taft's reputation for honesty and sincerity, Foraker sought to mollify reformers who called for the restoration of integrity on the Ohio bench. The Weekly Law Bulletin praised the appointment, noting that despite a mere 7 years before the bar, Taft was a very bright young man who already enjoys great popularity and personal respect. In a letter to Foraker, Taft acknowledged his profound appreciation. Considering the opportunity so honorable a position offers to a man of my age and circumstances, my debt to you is very great, he wrote. The responsibility you assume for me in making this appointment will always be a strong incentive to an industrious and conscientious discharge of my duties. To Taft, who would be the youngest judge in the state of Ohio, this appointment represented the welcome beginning of just the career he wanted. His work as court reporter, prosecuting attorney, litigator, and counsel for the Bar Association had prepared him well, giving him an intimate acquaintance with varied aspects of the law. The golden chance to sit on the Superior Court represented the first establishment of a judicial career that would eventually lead, after a painful detour as president, to his ultimate destination, Chief Justice of the United States. When Theodore Roosevelt took up the study of law, he was not sure where it would lead, nor whether he even wanted to be a lawyer. Foremost, he was about to be married and had a responsibility, despite the inheritance his father left him, to support his wife and family. Within 2 weeks of entering Columbia Law School on October 6, 1880, he acknowledged his hands full attending to various affairs. While mornings were spent in school, his afternoons and evenings were devoted to wedding arrangements. The marriage was scheduled to take place at Chestnut Hill on October 27th, his 22nd birthday. It almost frightens me, in spite of my own happiness, he revealed in his diary, to think that perhaps I may not make her happy, but I shall try so hard, and if ever a man love woman, I love her. The wedding was celebrated at noon on a balmy autumn day at the Unitarian Church in Brookline before a large crowd, including Theodore's childhood friend, Edith Carroll. After a sumptuous reception at the Lee Mansion, the young couple spent the night in a hotel suite and then headed to Oyster Bay. They remained 2 weeks at the family's country home, where their every need was attended to by a cook, maid, and groom. Our intense happiness is too sacred to be written about, Roosevelt asserted in his diary, then proceeded to detail idyllic days spent driving their buggy, roaming through the woods and fields, playing equally matched lawn tennis, and reading poetry before blazing fires at night. On November 17th, Roosevelt resumed his law school classes. He set forth shortly after 7:30 a.m. from his mother's house on 57th Street, where he and Alice would spend the winter, to begin the 3-mile walk to the 4-story law building on Great Jones Street at the corner of Lafayette Place. At Columbia, as at Harvard, he stood out as an energetic questioner of the lectures, his intensity provoking a mixture of resentment and admiration in his classmates. While the pleasure he took in his studies is amply expressed in his journal, he was troubled that some of the teaching of the law books and of the classroom seemed to me to be against justice. He noted critically that we are concerned with the question of what law is, not what it ought to be. Nevertheless, more than 1,000 pages of handwritten notes during his 2 years of study testify to his diligence, and he impressed professors with his amazingly deft grasp of materials. During his first year in law school, Roosevelt assumed several positions formerly held by his father on the boards of charitable organizations. Hopeful this philanthropic work might prove fulfilling, he found himself ill-suited to follow in his father's footsteps. I tried faithfully to do what father had done, he confessed to his reporter friend Jacob Riis, but I did it poorly. I joined this and that committee, Father had done good work on so many, but in the end I found out that we have each to work in his own way to do our best. Despite his relative youth, Roosevelt demonstrated a confidence and clear-minded assessment of his own interests and capabilities, making him far more successful than Taft in refusing endeavors he found uncongenial. During this hectic phase of his life, Roosevelt even managed to try his hand as an author. As a senior at Harvard, he had embarked on a project that would become his first published work, The Naval War of 1812. His interest in the war had been sparked by a volume in the Porcellian Library by the reigning British authority on the subject, William James. Angered by the biased, boastful approach of the author, who appeared afflicted with a hatred toward the Americans, Roosevelt searched out American historians of the war, only to find their accounts equally distorted by jingoism. With the goal of writing an impartial history, he began research into the official papers and records on both sides of the conflict. By the spring semester of his first year at Columbia, he noted, "I spend most of my spare time in the Astor Library on my naval history." In the reading room, a wonderfully open two-story high hall, surrounded by gilded balconies and books arranged in double-height alcoves, he pored through official letters, logbooks, original contracts, and muster rolls. With the same inordinate concentration he gave to law lectures in the mornings, Theodore spent afternoons at the library compiling figures to compare warring ships in terms of tonnage and guns, researching the number of officers and men on each side as the war began and ended. He concluded that in most of the battles at sea, the American fleets overpowered the British, but that American historians, desiring to embellish the valor of the commanders, minimized the difference. British historians retaliated with even greater exaggerations. With his fierce utilization of every waking moment, Roosevelt stole time to write both before and after a full round of social engagements, including formal balls, nights at the theater, large receptions, and more intimate parties. "We're dining out in 20 minutes," Alice lightheartedly complained, "and T.D.'s drawing little ships." On May 12, 1881, the day after classes ended, Theodore and Alice sailed on their delayed honeymoon to Europe. His diary tells of joyous days crowded with visits to castles, cathedrals, and museums, with sailing excursions on inland rivers and carriage rides through the Alps. "Alice is the best traveling companion I have ever known," Theodore marveled. "Altogether, it would be difficult to imagine any two people enjoying a trip more." When they reached Zermatt, however, Theodore pursued a solo adventure, the irresistible challenge of climbing the dangerous Matterhorn. "I was anxious to go up it," he acknowledged to Bammy, "because it is reputed very difficult, and a man who has been up it can fairly claim to have taken his degree as, at any rate, a subordinate kind of mountaineer." In the company of two guides, finding the climb very laborious but with enough peril to make it exciting, he reached the summit. Still, Roosevelt managed to work on his naval history throughout the trip, lugging his books and papers from country to country. "You would be amused to see me writing it here," he told Bammy. "I have plenty of information now, but I can't get it into words. I'm afraid it is too big a task for me. I wonder if I won't find everything in life too big for my abilities. Well, time will tell." Returning home from Europe, he resumed his law courses in early October. "I'm working fairly at my law," he reported a few weeks later, "and hardest of all at my book." In early December, he delivered a 500-page manuscript to Putnam's. Recalling this maiden literary voyage, Roosevelt acknowledged years later that some of the chapters were so dry that they would have made a dictionary seem light reading by comparison. Nonetheless, uniformly favorable reviews hailed his accomplishment, noting flashes of the muscular tone and vigor that would mark his mature prose. "The volume is an excellent one in every respect," wrote the New York Times, "and shows in so young an author the best promise for a good historian. Fearlessness of statement, caution, endeavor to be impartial, and a brisk and interesting way of telling events." It was an auspicious beginning. He learned early on the rewards attendant upon painstaking research and the meticulous deployment of facts. The boldness with which he challenged entrenched authority was refreshing to critics, although one reviewer noted that his running criticisms of the British authority suggested a comparison with those zealous sailors who overloaded their carronades so as to very much destroy the effect of their fire. In the years ahead, even as he turned his prodigious energies and talents to the world of politics, Theodore Roosevelt never stopped writing. Though he may never have realized his dream of writing a book that would rank in the very first class, he produced a substantial body of excellent work, 40 books in all, in addition to hundreds of magazine articles and book reviews. He covered an astonishing range of subjects, including narratives of hunting expeditions, meditations and natural histories on wolves, the grizzly bear and the black-tailed deer, biographies of public figures, literary essays, commentaries on war and peace, and sketches of birds. His four-volume history of the American frontier would win high praise from eminent historian Frederick Jackson Turner, who termed it the first really satisfactory history of the field, a wonderful story, most entertainingly told. His many-sided writings would prove an invaluable resource during his presidency, passionately linking him with hunters, naturalists, bird lovers, historians, biographers, conservationists, educators, sailors, soldiers, and sportsmen. Everything was of interest to him, marveled the French ambassador, Jean-Jules Jusserand. People of today, people of yesterday, animals, minerals, stones, stars, the past, the future. The British statesman Viscount Lee agreed. Whether the subject of the moment was political economy, the Greek drama, tropical fauna or flora, the Irish sagas, protective coloration in nature, metaphysics, the technique of football, or post-futurist painting, he was equally at home. The road that would lead Roosevelt into public life began at Morton Hall, the barn-like room over a saloon, at 59th Street and 5th Avenue that served as the Republican headquarters for the 21st District. That district encompassed both the elegant neighborhoods along Madison Avenue and the more populous tenement sections on the west side of Manhattan. While Roosevelt had found philanthropic administration ill-suited to his restless temperament, he longed to honor his father and family through his own efforts to help the cause of better government in New York. When he began inquiring about the local Republican organization, he was warned by his privileged circle that district politics were low, the province of saloon keepers, horse car conductors, and the like, men who would be rough and brutal and unpleasant to deal with. Their caution did nothing to deter Roosevelt. I answered that if this were so, it merely meant that the people I knew did not belong to the governing class, he observed, and that the other people did, and that I intended to be one of the governing class. In addition to attending the monthly meetings, Roosevelt stopped by in the evenings at the smoke-filled room with its benches, cuspidors, and poker tables that functioned as a club room. I went around there often enough to have the men get accustomed to me, and to have me get accustomed to them, Roosevelt explained, so that we began to speak the same language, and so that each could begin to live down in the other's mind what Bret Hart has called the defective moral quality of being a stranger. To the machine politicians who represented the tenement population, Roosevelt initially appeared very much an alien. He looked like a dude, side whiskers and all, you know, one of them commented. Over time, however, as he had done at Harvard, he won over his comrades with the warmth, unabashed intensity, and pluck of his personality. He grew particularly close to Joe Murray, the thick-set, red-haired Irish boss, with a fine head, a fighter's chin, and twinkling eyes, the man whom Roosevelt later credited with launching his political career. He was by nature as straight a man, as fearless, and as staunchly loyal as anyone whom I have ever met, Roosevelt wrote in his autobiography. When Murray determined that the incumbent Republican assemblyman for the 21st District could not hold his seat in the fall elections in 1881, having recently been linked to corruption, he surprised his compatriots by nominating the 23-year-old Roosevelt, unknown to anyone in Morton Hall 8 months earlier. The shrewd boss calculated that victory over the Democratic candidate would be assured if the Republican machine mustered its regular totals while Roosevelt mobilized the college-educated men and the swells who rarely voted in local elections. Murray's instincts proved correct. On November 1st, a list of eminent New Yorkers, including future Secretary of War Elihu Root, and Columbia Law professor Theodore W. Dwight heartily endorsed Roosevelt as a man of high character, conspicuous for his honesty and integrity. A week later, Theodore Roosevelt was elected as the youngest member of the New York State Assembly, launching an unprecedented political career, one that would culminate less than two decades later in his becoming the youngest president in the history of the United States. On January 2, 1882, Theodore Roosevelt was sworn in, along with 127 other assemblymen. "My first days in the legislature were much like those of a boy in a strange school," he recalled. "My fellow legislators and I eyed one another with mutual distrust. The legislature was Democratic. I was a Republican from the Silk Stocking District." Assemblyman Isaac Hunt, who later became a close friend, would never forget the first time he saw Roosevelt. "He came in as if he had been ejected by a catapult," Hunt recalled. "He pulled off his coat. He was dressed in full dress. He had been to dinner somewhere. With hair parted in the middle, eyeglasses suspended by a silk cord, and elegant gloves, he cut a unique figure." For the first 6 weeks, according to Hunt, Theodore Roosevelt was uncharacteristically taciturn. He was like Moses in the wilderness, but all the while watching and learning. That night, in his private diary, he delineated an analysis of the character of each man in that legislature. His initial reactions to the other assemblymen revealed that he was still far from overcoming the defective moral quality of being a stranger. His Republican colleagues, he wrote, were bad enough, but over half the Democrats, including almost all of the city Irish, are vicious, stupid-looking scoundrels with apparently not a redeeming trait. The men who belonged to the Tammany Democratic machine, furthermore, seemed totally unable to speak with even an approximation of good grammar. Not one of them can string three intelligible sentences together to save his neck. Clearly, the Tammany men were as contemptuous and antagonistic to Roosevelt as he was of them. "Here is a perfect dude," bellowed Tammany Lieutenant John McManus, referring to Roosevelt's side whiskers and his dandified manner of dress. A practical joker nearly twice Roosevelt's size, McManus let it be known that he intended to toss the young upstart in a blanket. Outwardly uncowed, a belligerent Roosevelt confronted McManus. "By God, if you try anything like that, I'll kick you, I'll bite you, I'll kick you in the balls. I'll do anything to you. You'd better let me alone." And he did. The more serious altercation took place at Hearst's Roadhouse, a popular gathering place for assemblymen and reporters 6 miles out of Albany. Late one winter afternoon, Roosevelt entered Hearst's and was greeted by three jeering bullies who raucously mocked his appearance and lack of a winter coat. "Why don't your mother buy you an overcoat? Won't Mama's boy catch cold?" A reporter present noted that Roosevelt ignored them until it was clear they would not let up. Finally, he confronted the three. "You little dude," taunted one, while his companion took a swipe at Roosevelt. But quick as lightning, Roosevelt slipped his glasses into his side pocket, and in another second he had laid two of the trio on the floor. The third quit cold. The story soon made the rounds in the State House, along with the significant fact that once the men got off the floor, Roosevelt invited them to join him in a glass of ale. The vigorous tempers displayed by young Taft and Roosevelt remained with them throughout their lives. The aftermath of their anger, however, was handled very differently. "When Taft gives way to his," one reporter observed, "it is to inflict a merciless lashing upon its victim, for whom, thereafter, he has no use whatever. With Roosevelt, it is a case of powder and spark. There is a vivid flash and a deafening roar, but when the smoke is blown away, that is the end." Roosevelt quickly determined that his colleagues could be divided into three groups, a small circle of very good men, fellow reformers like Isaac Hunt, William O'Neill, and Mike Costello, anxious to fight against corrupt political machines, made up the first. The second group, the majority, were neither very good nor very bad, but went one way or the other according to the strength of the various conflicting influences acting around, behind, and upon them. Finally, the very bad men, in both parties, ever susceptible to bribery, made up a rough third of the assembly and were essentially owned by various business interests. Good legislation could be passed only if the conscience of the public was awakened, exerting pressure on the passive majority. Immediately, Roosevelt understood that the most effective means of circumventing the machines and transforming popular sentiment was to establish a good rapport with the press corps. About 30 reporters from across the state covered the legislature in Albany, where a rigid hierarchy governed their assigned seats. In front-row box seats facing the assemblymen sat George F. Spinney of the New York Times, Hugh Hastings of the Albany Express, H. Calkins of the New York World, and A. W. Lyman of the New York Sun. Reporters for the New York Herald, the New York Tribune, and the Brooklyn Times sat in the second and third rows. Journalists representing smaller papers were consigned to the bleachers in the back of the chamber. Roosevelt's expansive demeanor, manic energies, and often original, always articulate and quotable statements made him a favorite among the journalists. A mutually productive alliance was forged between the journalists and Roosevelt that would boost his political career at every stage. The Times reporter George Spinney took an immediate liking to Roosevelt, calling him a good-hearted man, with a good, honest laugh. Spinney, who would later become editor and publisher of the Times, was considered then one of the best reporters in the state, lauded for the vigor, thoroughness, and intelligence of his daily dispatches from Albany. Spinney marveled at the speed with which the rookie assemblyman mastered every aspect of the state legislature. "He grew like a beanstalk," the Times reporter recalled in a conversation with Assemblyman Hunt 40 years later. "He would just stand a man up against the wall and interview him and ask, 'How do you do this in your district and county? And what is this thing and that thing?' He went right to the bottom of the whole thing. He knew more about state politics at the end of that first session than 90% of them did." Hunt himself, described by a contemporary as a mighty tree that stood out in the forest, had never encountered anyone like Roosevelt. "He would go away Friday afternoon," Hunt remembered, "and Monday he would throw out new things he never had before, just like a child that you see grow from day to day. That is the way he grew. He increased in stature and strength materially all the time. In that first session," Hunt wrote, "I thought I knew more than he did, but before we got through, he grew right away from me." Brooklyn Eagle reporter William C. Hudson, who resided at the same hotel as Roosevelt, was boggled by the young legislator's early morning routine. It was Roosevelt's habit to come into the breakfast room with a rush, copies of all the morning papers he could lay his hands on under his arm, and seating himself, go through those papers with a rapidity that would have excited the jealousy of the most rapid exchange editor. He threw each paper, as he finished it, on the floor, unfolded, until at the end there was, on either side of him, a pile of loose papers as high as the table for the servants to clear away. And all this time, he would be taking part in the running conversation of the table. Had anyone supposed that this inspection of the papers was superficial, he would have been sadly mistaken. Roosevelt saw everything, grasped the sense of everything, and formed an opinion on everything which he was eager to maintain, at any risk. Roosevelt's prodigious learning curve was tested after only 2 months in Albany, when he took a leading role in the battle to impeach a corrupt state Supreme Court judge, Theodore Westbrook. The battle pitted Roosevelt against a similar insidious alliance to the one Taft had uncovered in the Campbell debacle in Cincinnati. In December 1881, shortly before Roosevelt was sworn in, the New York Times had published a 9-column piece condemning Judge Westbrook's collusion with notorious Wall Street financier Jay Gould in an elaborate scheme to gain control of the elevated railway system in New York. "We went after him with yards of space," recalled Spinney, who conducted several phases of the investigation. Over the years, the swashbuckling Gould had amassed railroads, steamship lines, telegraph companies, and newspapers in a series of well-planned raids, stitching together an empire that stretched from coast to coast. In 1881, he moved to appropriate the Manhattan Elevated Railway Company, one of the first outfits to engineer and develop a steam-powered rapid transit system for the city. A burdensome lawsuit devised by Gould's accomplices was brought against the company, forcing it into receivership. Judge Westbrook, who had been Gould's legal counsel, was selected to preside over the bankrupt company. Holding court in Gould's private offices, Westbrook issued a series of onerous rulings calculated to panic stockholders into throwing their shares on the market, depressing the stock to almost nothing. At that point, the Gould Syndicate began buying. Once Gould had gained control of the valuable property, Judge Westbrook mysteriously decreed the company solvent, and the stock rose sharply. This simple, perfidious maneuver cost thousands of innocent stockholders their life savings. The comprehensive account of this stock-jobbing scheme created a stir in the newspaper world. At issue, the Brooklyn Eagle proclaimed, was not simply the transgressions of a justice who prostituted himself, but the fact that the state government in all its branches had prostrated itself before the robber barons. These things show where the wealth of the country is going. They show that the farmer, the artisan, and the merchant are sweating their lives out to enrich a little coterie of blooded knaves who regard their fellow men as the spider does the fly or the wolf the sheep. If the charges were substantiated, the Auburn Advertiser argued, nothing less than Westbrook's impeachment would restore the dignity and respect of the state Supreme Court. Officials should be taught that they are the servants of the people, chided the Times, not of rings and cliques. All agreed that Westbrook could not remain silent under the severe arraignment of the Times. In fact, that is precisely what Westbrook did. His strategic silence on these charges had nearly extinguished interest in the entire matter when Theodore Roosevelt picked the case up in March 1882. Isaac Hunt had prompted Roosevelt's involvement after a second unrelated article appeared in the New York Herald accusing Judge Westbrook of a flagrant abuse of power and conflict of interest. He had appointed receivers for defunct insurance companies and granted excessive fees to select lawyers, including his cousin and son, who handled the cases. Hunt suggested that Roosevelt introduce a resolution to investigate Judge Westbrook. Roosevelt agreed to consider the action, but would not take it up until he was sure there was evidence sufficient to warrant such a resolution. Recalling the Westbrook article in the New York Times 3 months earlier, as he seemed to remember anything he had read, Roosevelt approached the city editor, Henry Lowenthal, and asked to examine the corroborating evidence behind the December exposé. The editor later described an energetic young man who questioned and cross-questioned him throughout the entire night. Spinney, who had worked for Lowenthal before becoming the Albany correspondent, heard that the presses in the basement were finishing that day's edition in the early morning hours when the young assemblyman emerged with an armful of ammunition that included an incriminating letter in which Judge Westbrook told Gould, "I'm willing to go to the very verge of judicial discretion to serve your vast interests." On March 29, 1882, Roosevelt rose from his seat in the assembly. Noting that the newspaper charges made against Westbrook in relation to the Manhattan Elevated Railway had never been explained or fairly refuted, he offered a resolution empowering the Judiciary Committee to begin an investigation. This bold action created a sensation in the chamber. "By Jove," Hunt recalled, "it was like the bursting of a bombshell." Supporters of Westbrook and Gould quickly rallied, demanding a debate that automatically tabled the motion and threatened its indefinite postponement. The next day, an editorial in the New York Times praised Roosevelt's resolution. "Mr. Roosevelt correctly states that these charges have never been explained or fairly rebutted. Those who believe that Judge Westbrook has been unjustly assailed ought to welcome so good a chance of vindicating his character." A week later, Spinney recalled, Roosevelt suddenly interrupted the humdrum routine with the demand that all business be laid aside and his resolution of investigation be taken up. The move was so unexpected and so sudden that dilatory tactics were out of the question. When Roosevelt began to speak, the House, for almost the only time during the session, grew silent. Though Roosevelt was not then an accomplished speaker, he delivered his speech slowly and clearly, and his voice filled the chamber, abominable as were its acoustics. A frequent gesture of his determination was the resounding blow of his right fist as he smacked it in the palm of his left hand. "The men who were mainly concerned in this fraud," Roosevelt began, alluding to Jay Gould, Russell Sage, and Cyrus Field, "were men whose financial dishonesty is a matter of common notoriety. requiring of the judiciary extreme efforts to assure the appearance of probity. Instead, the judge answered petitions in the offices of one of the trio of investors and held court in the office of another who was nothing but a wealthy shark. To address one aspect of the case, Westbrook appointed a man who was employed by Jay Gould. Every decision was rendered to enable Gould and his conspirators to seize control of the railway at a baldly manipulated bargain price. "We have a right to demand that our judiciary should be kept beyond reproach," Roosevelt ardently continued, "and we have a right to demand that if we find men against whom there is not only suspicion, but almost a certainty that they have had collusion with men whose interests were in conflict with the interests of the public, they shall at least be required to bring positive facts with which to prove there has not been such collusion, and they ought themselves to have been first to demand such an investigation." Beyond a shadow of a doubt, Spinney believed, a vote at that juncture would have ensured the passage of his resolution. But former Governor Thomas Alvord took the floor and filibustered until the scheduled adjournment at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Speaking in disjointed sentences and fragmentary thoughts, Alvord advised the rookie assemblyman to find proof for his accusations rather than stoop to slanderous utterances or newspaper stories, because human reputation and human characters were too sacred to be trifled with. Though Roosevelt was temporarily outmaneuvered by veteran opposition, the day's proceedings, Spinney observed, made the youngest member of the assembly the most talked-of man in the state. That night, from his room at the Kenmore Hotel, Roosevelt wrote to Alice with no small gratification, "I have drawn blood by my speech against the elevated railway judges, and have come in for any amount both of praise and abuse from the newspapers. It is rather the hit of the season so far, and I think I have made a success of it. Letters and telegrams of congratulation come pouring in on me from all quarters. But the fight is severe still." Roosevelt's speech to the assembly garnered widespread coverage, as he well knew it would. "Mr. Roosevelt has a most refreshing habit of calling men and things by their right names," the Times editorialized. "And in these days of judicial, ecclesiastical, and journalistic subserviency to the robber barons of the street, it needs some little courage in any public man to characterize them and their acts in fitting terms. There is a splendid career open for a young man of position, character, and independence like Mr. Roosevelt." Not surprisingly, Jay Gould's New York World castigated him in equal measure. "Before any official shall be subjected to the vexation and discredit of an investigation, some responsible person or association must prefer a charge accompanied with allegations of wrongdoing. Yet in this instance," the World complained, "an inexperienced legislator gets up from his seat and recites in a somewhat intemperate speech sundry hearsay charges against Judge Westbrook, based upon statements published in a newspaper." Roosevelt dismissed these attacks, according to Hunt, shedding criticism like water poured on a duck's back. He held his ground, even when an old family friend gently insisted that, while it was a good thing to have made the reform play, he should not overplay his hand. "I asked," Roosevelt recalled, "if that meant I was to yield to the ring in politics. He answered somewhat impatiently that I was entirely mistaken, as in fact I was, about there being merely a political ring, for the inner circle was, in truth, a miasma, an enormous knot of big businessmen and the politicians, lawyers, and judges who were in alliance with, and to a certain extent dependent upon them, and that the successful man had to win his success by the backing of the same forces, whether in law, business, or politics." The day before the House adjourned for Easter recess, Roosevelt was again frustrated in his attempt to bring the issue to a vote. During the break, however, newspapers continued to headline the story. By the time the legislature came back again, Hunt explained, the legislators had evidently heard from their home folks, because the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of the investigation. The first skirmish awakened Roosevelt to the massive, persuasive capacity of the press to stir public resolve and exert pressure on otherwise unassailable insiders. The investigation was entrusted to the Judiciary Committee, which, over the course of 7 weeks, conducted hearings in both New York and Albany. Despite an accumulation of damaging evidence, a majority declared that Westbrook's behavior, although indiscreet, did not warrant impeachment. Hunt later alleged that 3 decisive votes in favor of impeachment were lost in the middle of the night when the legislators were offered $2,500 each to sign the majority report. When the Judiciary Committee's decision was announced, Hunt recalled, Roosevelt was dancing and jumping about and full of fire and full of fury and full of fight. "Mr. Speaker! Mr. Speaker!" he called out, with a strident plea for his colleagues to accept the minority report calling for impeachment. "To you, members of the legislature of the greatest commonwealth in this great federal union, I say you cannot by your votes clear the judge. He stands condemned by his own acts in the eyes of all honest people. All you can do is to shame yourselves and give him a brief extension of his dishonored career. You cannot cleanse the leper. Beware lest you taint yourselves with his leprosy." Roosevelt's dramatic exhortation brought deathless silence to the chamber. But the Assembly nonetheless voted on May 31st to accept the majority report exonerating the judge. It was apparent to those familiar with politics, Spinney concluded, that every wire that could be pulled in both the dominant political parties to prevent impeachment was stretched to the tautest. "The action of the Assembly last night in voting to exonerate Judge Westbrook is simply disgraceful," declared the New York Herald. "We venture the assertion that the entire bench and 9/10 of the bar of the state are convinced that Judge Westbrook ought to be impeached." The New York Times titled its editorial, "A Miscarriage of Justice." The Brooklyn Eagle called the vote "an open avowal of contempt for public sentiment, for public intelligence, and common honesty." The Buffalo Express quoted from Roosevelt's speech and predicted that the young man's indictment expressed the general verdict. Though Roosevelt's first joust at entrenched corruption had failed, he emerged as a champion of reform, both within the Assembly and in the court of public opinion. Hunt maintained that Roosevelt won his spurs in that fight. While he had been derided as a society man and a dude prior to the Westbrook debate, he was now looked upon as a full-fledged man and worthy of anybody's esteem. When the session came to a close in early June, claimed Spinney, Roosevelt's name was known to every nook and corner of the state. "I rose like a rocket," Roosevelt remembered, proudly noting his re-election the following November, with an enormous majority, despite a Democratic sweep in the state elections. As a further sign of his swift and brilliant ascent, when the legislature convened in January of 1883, his Republican colleagues selected him, the youngest member of the Assembly, as their minority leader. Thereafter, he acknowledged, "I immediately proceeded to lose my perspective. I came an awful cropper, and had to pick myself up after learning by bitter experience the lesson that I was not all important. My head was swelled," he conceded, looking back upon his self-indulgent behavior in the aftermath of his sudden fame. "I would listen to no argument, no advice." In that second session, Hunt recalled, Roosevelt became a perfect nuisance, interrupting the business of the House in a manner so explosive and so radical and so indiscreet that even fellow reformers worried that he was becoming a damn fool. When contesting an issue, he yelled and pounded his desk, firing back with all the venom imaginary. Without restraint, he castigated the New York World as a paper of limited circulation and unlimited scurrility. He denounced the rotten Democratic Party, belittling the political lineage that ran down the roll from Polk, the mendacious, through Pierce, the copperhead, to Buchanan, who faced both ways. His colorful language invariably made headlines, spurring him to progressively more outlandish outbursts. His antics kept his name in print, but finally he was absolutely deserted and lamented that every bit of influence I had was gone. The things I wanted to do, I was powerless to accomplish. This grim, isolated reality prompted a radical reassessment. I thereby learned the invaluable lesson that in the practical activities of life, No man can render the highest service unless he can act in combination with his fellows, which means a certain amount of give and take between him and them. Restraining his histrionic rhetoric and making overtures to his fellow legislators, Roosevelt was able to establish common grounds of agreement. "I turned in to help them, and they turned to and gave me a hand," he reflected. "And so we were able to get things done." Roosevelt's developing sensibilities did not initially embrace the cause of labor seeking greater protection against the abusive onslaughts of the flourishing industrial order. Rather, he regarded union leaders as exceedingly unattractive persons, and considered the majority of labor bills introduced in the legislature foolish. The reigning laissez-faire doctrine, inculcated at Harvard as well as Yale, and accepted categorically by those within his privileged circle, had biased him, he later acknowledged, against all governmental schemes for the betterment of the social and industrial conditions of laborers. With unexamined confidence, he voted against increasing the minimum wage to 25 cents an hour, spoke in opposition to a bill that would limit streetcar conductors to 12-hour workdays, and fought against legislation to raise the salaries of New York's policemen and firemen. When the Cigar Makers Union introduced a bill to prohibit the manufacture of cigars in tenement houses, Roosevelt presumed from the outset he would vote against it. He had always believed that tenement owners had an absolute right to do as they wished with their own property. As he examined more closely the conditions leading to this bill, however, he began to question his inherited resistance to social legislation. Labor leader Samuel Gompers had long considered the production of cigars in unsanitary tenements one of the most dreadful, cancerous sores on the city of New York. Realizing that the only hope of eradicating a system that employed nearly 10,000 people lay in exposing the actual character of the evils, he conducted a personal inspection of the tenements, gaining entrance in the guise of a book agent peddling copies of Charles Dickens. Gompers made detailed notes of his observations and published comprehensive reports of his findings. He discovered that the capitalists who owned the tenement factories demanded grueling hours from their workers, mainly Jewish immigrants, and charged absurd rents for their filthy, ill-ventilated apartments. In one tenement house, 15 families crowded into three floors. Fathers, mothers, and children were at work stripping, drying, and wrapping cigars from 6 in the morning until midnight. In the yard, a breeding ground of disease with no drain to a sewer, lay large mounds of decaying tobacco. Another building housed 98 people from 20 families, with several families living and working together in one room. Everywhere, piles of tobacco and fetid tobacco scraps littered the floors, filling the air with overwhelming stench. The hallways were so dark and gloomy that even at midday it seemed like night. Roosevelt was shaken by these reports. He agreed to accompany Gompers on an inspection tour, pledging, if the conditions described really existed, he would do everything in his power to secure the passage of the bill. He admitted that he was a good deal shocked at what he found. While a few of the tenements provided living space for the workers apart from the sweatshops, the overwhelming majority had no separate accommodation. He long remembered one tenement in which 5 adults and several children were confined to a single room for sleeping, eating, and making cigars. The tobacco was stowed about everywhere, alongside the foul bedding and in a corner where there were scraps of food. After 2 additional forays into this dark underworld, Roosevelt was convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that the manufacturers of cigars in tenement houses was an evil thing from every standpoint, social, industrial, and hygienic. Though the proposed bill was a dangerous departure from the laissez-faire doctrine in which he thoroughly believed, he championed its passage and joined a group of supporters urging Governor Grover Cleveland to sign it. Once the bill became law in March 1883, the cigar makers straightaway brought suit, arguing their right to hold property, guaranteed by the state constitution, was violated by the new regulations. The case, In re Jacobs, eventually made its way to the New York Court of Appeals, where the justices declared that the law indeed deprived the cigar makers of their fundamental rights of liberty without due process of law. Furthermore, the court argued, the legislation did not constitute a legitimate use of the state's police power to regulate behavior detrimental to the public welfare, for tobacco was